Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The snow this year is better at Innsbruck.
But not at St. Moritz.
Ferrara.
Bond. James Bond.
Luigi.
Really, 007.
We have come all the way down from Manchester to meet one of James Bond's favourite allies, Mr. John Marino, and he played Luigi Ferrara in one of our favourite Bond films, For Your Eyes Only. So, can't quite believe this is happening. It's amazing to see you in real life, John.
Well, it's the first time for me too, so yeah. I'm just as excited and nervous as you.
No.
I am. Because then all of a sudden you think, well, what am I going to say? What have I done in my life? Is anything worth listening to, hearing about? I've no idea.
Believe me, John, we've spent an hour with you and there is a lot to hear.
The thing is, if I could remember it.
We just had a lovely breakfast brunch with John, and he was telling us some amazing stories.
Yeah.
About his life. I mean, I suppose we should start there, John, with your upbringing and amazing, about three or four different countries were involved in your childhood.
My father was from the southwest of, well, he originally was born in Villarreal. The people who follow Liverpool will know where Villarreal is. and his family immigrated to southwest France when he was 8 in 1918, just after the First World War. And he stayed there, became an engineer, but he joined a traveling circus and decided he wanted to be, first of all, an acrobat, 1935, something like that. And he traveled around England, and in fact, came to London in about 1936 with this acrobatic group. But he knew he didn't want to be an acrobat, he wanted to be a juggler. So they started perfecting his skills as a juggler. Then he was actually touring France, and he went to Strasbourg and met my mother, whose parents owned a hotel and restaurant. They met, they fell in love, she eloped. He was then in Paris. They eloped and they got married. He then perfected his act. And I think in 1939, Lou Grade contacted him saying, please, will you come to England? I've got some very lucrative jobs for you. And so my mother and I, then 3 months old, came to England, was met by Leslie Grade at Victoria Station. And then literally months later, war broke out and they stayed here and became British citizens. And wow. That's how it started. And I remember as a child standing in the wings and watching wonderful acts like, I don't know, who were they? Vera Lynn, Buster Keaton. And all those silent movies that came over just after the war and did...
You mentioned Laurel and Hardy.
Absolutely, Laurel and Hardy. And all the great stars. They worked with Peter Sellers and Morecambe and Wise and things like that. And so I had upbringing of just standing in the wings and watching these wonderful variety acts. And I suppose by osmosis, I learnt things like comedy timing. Just seeing just how you drop a line in, you know, how you stop them laughing when they shouldn't laugh and wait for the punchline. I just learned that just by watching how wonderful the technique they had. And so my parents were working with someone called Lord Bernard Miles, who was an actor, but during the war there was no jobs for actors, so he developed a monologue in which he became a Chiltern Hill farmer. And he used to come on stage with a great big cartwheel and became a Chiltern Hill farmer and talked about the life in the village and the Chiltern Hills and all like that. And then after the war, he ran the Mermaid Theatre, which was in the city, Puddle Dock. And he asked my parents, when my father retired, to come and be front of house managers. And that's how I got involved in a way. But before that, of course,
yes,
my father and mother used to take us on these wonderful exotic summer holidays to Europe, Italy, Venice, Rome, Copenhagen, south of France. And when I was about 16, 17, I was in a hotel in Nice. My father was working in the casino and I came in. And there were two gendarmes at the reception, and I got my key, went up to my room, the telephone rang, they said, please, will you come down and bring your passport? I came down, and the two gendarmes said, you're under arrest for draft dodging. And I said, but I'm a British citizen. It says here, British citizen. He said, yes, look at the second paragraph, and it says, people of dual nationality will not be protected by Her Majesty's government for such things as military service in their country of origin. And it's quite there on the second paragraph.
Oh, wow.
So I was put in prison. I was shipped to Marseille. I was court-martialed. I was acquitted and thought, well, that's it. I'm free to go home. But no, they said, no, now you're going to be taken to a caserne and you'll do your military service in the French army. This is the late 50s, 60, I suppose, 1959, 60, during the Algerian War. And I was on guard duty one day outside the barracks, and this young German, I knew he was German by his accent, came up to me, tried to speak to me in French in a very, very bad accent. And I said, listen, do you speak English? And he said, oh, yeah, yeah. He said, I'm looking for the Foreign Legion Air barracks. And I said, oh, it's just around the corner. I said, that's where you have to go. So he's obviously going to join the Foreign Legion. And when I was there in the caserne, the barracks, I got a phone call from headquarters saying the British Navy are in port. And normally the French army give a courtesy coach to the ratings and captains to take them around the south of France. And I found that. I went to my captain and I said, listen, can I be co-driver on the coach? Because I can speak English to them, you know. And he said, if you give me your word as an English gentleman, not to desert. And I said, of course I'll give you my word, you know. So we arrived on the dock in a single-decker 80-passenger bus, and all the ratings came out, all 80 of them, or 60, what it was, and I stood there in my French uniform. I said, good morning, chaps. I said, you won't believe this, but I'm actually English. And they said, oh, get off. I told them a little story, you know, and this went on for 3 days. We took them around Avignon and all the nice historical places around the south of France. And on the third day, we arrived in to offload the last ratings, and a lieutenant came down and said, we've just heard your story from the ratings. The captain wants to see you. And it was a big factory ship and two submarines. And so I went to the captain's ward, wherever it was, and he said, I've just heard this extraordinary story. Is this true? And I said, yes. He said, look, we sail at midnight. If you want to stay on board, we'll take you out. And I said, you know, I'm really sorry about this, but I give my word.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
As an English gentleman, not to desert. And he said, I quite understand. Okay, well, I mean, amazing story. Anyway, you're quite willing to stay on board and we'll get you out of the country. So I said, no, I've got to go back. So I did go back, and about 18 months later, I renounced my French nationality, and I was free to come back.
Wow.
Yeah, I forgot to tell you that. Crazy story. But then I before that, when I was a young man, I joined an amateur dramatic group because I thought I wanted to be an actor, really, rather than a juggler. My father was a juggler. And so I did join this amateur dramatic group when I was about 13, 14. I really enjoyed it. So my parents were now in the Mermaid Theatre in front of house managers. And I met Bernard Miles. But I'd joined the Central School of Dramatic Art and did a year when Bernard Miles's daughter said, John, I'm forming a new repertory company. Would you like to join us? So I left the drama school and went to join the Margate Stage Company. And I stayed with them for about 3 years. We toured around Newcastle and Manchester.
Hey.
The Arts Theatre in Manchester. And so that was the start of, that's the beginning of becoming an actor. So I did, I was doing a television series called The Talisman about the Third Crusades. I was playing Philip of France. and it was about Richard the Lionheart, yeah. when I got this call from my agent to go to meet Debbie McWilliams at Eon Production, number 3 of South Audley Street. And I said, what is it about? He said, well, it's James Bond. I said, oh, is it? I didn't really yeah. think much about it. I thought, oh, well, all right. I'm doing a BBC. I've been doing this for 13 weeks. So, I mean, I was working. So I went to this place and there was Debbie. And she said, listen, we're in the waiting room. I'll tell you what's going to happen. We'll talk. And then when I get the signal, we'll go into the back room where everyone is. They'll all be there. But just, I'll ask you a question. Just talk to me. And that's what I did. And they put in a big chair. It was like a throne. So I sat there and Debbie just asked me questions, what I was doing. And I was telling them, I said, well, I feel quite comfortable here because I spent the last 13 weeks sitting on a throne. So I feel quite happy. Anyway, there was John and Cubby and his wife. They were all there, but I take my glasses off to do the interview. So I really couldn't see anyone. I was just assuming where they would be. But 3 days later, I got the call saying, you've got it.
Oh, amazing.
You've got the part.
Yeah. Yes.
And I went to celebrate at Joe Allen's, and I was having dinner with a friend of mine, and I saw a friend of mine on a table not very far away, and I went over to say to her, I said, yeah, she was, I'd just done the Ian McKellen season, yes. with him for 3 years, and she was in the company, and I said, I've just got this one amazing job, and I was speaking to the other person who was sitting with her, and I said, do you know, I've got this job, I'm doing a Bond film, and yeah. and she said, I know job, I'm Debbie.
Oh, right.
McWilliams. I was telling. Oh, it was so embarrassing.
That's amazing.
She said, "John, I just, you know, I cast you. We were talking 3 days ago, and I couldn't remember her." But anyway, that's how
Brilliant.
I got the part.
Oh,
and then we went for the costume fitting. And after about 3 or 4 weeks, I got a call from the costume department saying, "John, can you meet in Oxford Circus and?" We'll get you fitted out. So I assume we'd be going down to Knightsbridge, going to Harrods and, you know, things like that. We walked into the nearest C&A store. And that's where my costumes came from. You know, C&A.
But did you get the script before then? Or did you know who you were playing? Or
I knew I was playing. Yes, yeah. I did know I was playing. And it was... it was a good part.
It was, yeah.
Bloody good part. Six scenes. I mean, not all were shot, but I did have six scenes. And then I thought, well, it was quite extraordinary being in the Bond film because you've just done the BBC and, yeah. you know, you eat out a double-decker bus at lunchtime.
Yes.
You know, you've been on one of those. And then all of a sudden you arrive in Cortina and they give you everything. Oh. You've got a driver, you've got a stand-in, you've got everything's there. You've got incredible food. And you're staying in a 5-star hotel.
Yeah, yeah.
You're meeting all the other actors, you know, Lynn Holly Johnson, Charles Dance, John Wyman, cameraman. We're all staying in these amazing hotels. And the car will pick you up. John, you know, at X time, will take you to makeup and put you in costumes. And you'll do the first scene, which is by the ice rink.
Yes. So yeah.
So that's how it started. That was the first scene we shot. It was so bloody cold. In fact, between takes, we had to go into the local cafe, which was right on the rink, to thaw out. Because it was freezing. The sun was out, but it was freezing. Everyone was in Arctic clothes, apart from us, the actors. You know, Roger was always very stoic, but, you know, he was lovely. But,
oh, yeah.
He had the trick of always telling you dirty jokes before a take. You
know. To put you off?
I think it's to relax you.
Yes, okay, yeah.
You
yeah.
know, you used to, you just started, you hear this one about the Englishman, Irishman, and I listened, of course, because it's Roger.
Yeah, yeah.
And then punchline came straight before action.
Yeah.
And of course, by then you were laughing, so you, cut. Roger, can you not do that? You know.
but that's genius in itself, isn't
it? Yeah.
You know.
Professional.
He was wonderful because at one point in that, the very first scene in the film where you first see me and him,
yes,
we do that, the bit we've just done.
Yeah.
John said, oh, all right, we've done that two-shot, John. We'll do a reverse on Roger. And Roger says, why are you doing a reverse on me? No, give it to John. I mean, I'm in the film all the time.
Oh.
Give the close-up to John.
Brilliant, and that's what's
so
in the film.
Good.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, generosity.
The snow this year is better at Innsbruck.
But not at San Moritz.
Ferrara.
Bond.
James.
Luigi.
I presume London's briefed you?
If looks in Cortina will find him. I have a reliable Greek contact here, an Anglophile. He helped us out last year on a smuggling operation.
Then what's he doing in Cortina?
He spends a few months a year here at the chalet. He's in shipping, insurance, oil exploration. Knows everything going on. Very reliable. The British gave him the King's Medal for resistance fighting during the war.
Yes, but can I meet him?
I've set it up. He's waiting for us at the Olympic ice rink.
That was John Glenn's first film, wasn't it?
So it was.
I know they knew each other, of course.
They knew each other, yeah. I think so. But you wouldn't have known that it was John's first film, because it was so in control. Well, being an editor, he knew exactly what he needed. He only needed what he needed to do the cuts. He knew how much. So it was, you know, it was one take, two takes, one take, two takes. He knew exactly what he wanted.
And as an observation, John Glenn's films are probably the best at storytelling in the series, because there's not much excess fat on them. You know,
they flow very well.
Yeah, yeah. And it was. But I do have a story. I'm going to have to stand up. On the third day, we shot the first scenes. We shot in the ice rink, but the second, the third, or fourth day, said John, we're going to do the stuff where we first meet you. So he said, the car will pick you up at 8 o'clock. You'll have makeup and costumes. You'll already be in makeup and costumes. Just go to the location. They'll drop you off. And I got there, and what looked like a very small bus terminal. Hmm. And I walked in, and I didn't see anyone there apart from the second assistant. And I said, where is everybody? He said, well, they're on location. I said, well, isn't this it? He said, no, John. We're going. He said, come over to the window. I'm going to stand up here. Come over to the window. And he said, you see that mountain up there? I said, yeah. He said, well, across the valley, we're going to go up to that mountain. I said, well, how are we going to get there? He said, are we going to take a car or a bus? He said, no, we're going in that. And I looked across what looked like the back end of a small wooden van. And I said, in that? He said, John, that is a cable car.
Right.
And I'd never seen a cable car. I'd seen them on film.
And
then I noticed the ropes, the cables going across this huge valley, you know, straight up this mountain. I said, oh, God, I said, well, and by then Roger arrived. And I said, and a lot of other young skiers had arrived. And I said, I rushed up to Roger. I said, Roger, this is not the location. He said, yeah, I know. I said, this is the location. I said, look, we're going up to the top of that mountain up there. He said, yes, I know, John. I said, and we're going in that. He said, John, I know. I said, Roger, I'm petrified of heights.
Right.
I'm petrified of heights. He said, well, I feel a bit queasy about that as well, John. I tell you what we'll do. Let me think. We'll go in before all the young skiers go in, and we'll stand in the middle of the cable car. Then we'll let all the young skiers stand around us where we won't be able to see out. And I said, well, I think I will be able to see out, Roger. He said, well, look, we'll hug each other, we'll close our eyes, and we'll sing. And I said, sing? What shall we sing? He said, we'll sing that Vera Lynn song. We'll meet again, don't know when. I said, Roger, isn't that a bit... I feel a bit funny about singing that song. So that's what we did.
Yeah.
We hugged each other. We had our eyes closed and we sang, we'll meet again. But, I mean, luckily there was no smartphones in those days, because had there been smartphones, people would have been clicking and saying, Roger Moore found in a cable car hugging a bloke.
Yeah. You'd be a YouTube sensation, John.
It would have been.
Singing Vera Lynn.
Singing Vera Lynn. Oh. But it was wonderful. We had a wonderful time. And I spent most of my time with, well, Roger would turn up everywhere. We'd go to the nightclubs. He would always be there.
Right.
He was one of the lads.
Had you met him before? Because you were on The Persuaders, is that right?
I did meet him before, but I met him even earlier when my father was working in Variety in Swansea, and he was working on the bill with Dorothy Squires.
Oh, yeah. Was he married to her?
Yes.
Yes, he was.
Either married or engaged. Yes, but yes. And Dorothy came up to my father and said, do you think you can give me some physical exercise? I want to get him trim. My young boyfriend's coming tonight. And and so I was at the stage door when, at the end of the show, when Dorothy Squires came down, and behind her was this handsome young man, and that was Roger.
Wow.
I never told him that story. I'd actually met him when I was 14 years old. No, I never told him.
So he was in his 20s then, probably.
Yes, I think there was a... I was about 42 and Roger was 50 or something.
50s, once, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, so there was about a, so he was, a, yes, yeah. Early 20s, I might have been 14, 15. Wow. But that's the first time, and I never told him that I'd already met him in the Persuaders. Yeah. Well. I never told him that either.
It's a funny situation.
Funny situation. Yeah. So, but it was lovely. Absolutely lovely.
Was the Persuaders before I the Bond, remember. Though? It probably would have been, wouldn't it?
I think it was.
Yeah, it would have been by then. Yeah.
I mean, yes, it was. Yes. So that was my experience, and you know, and then I realised that it was a huge, because everyone knew us in Cortina. They knew we were the James Bond film was being
done. Took over the place, wasn't it?
Yeah, completely. Yeah. We all had the same kind of après-ski uniforms on, so everyone knew we were connected with the Ian production. So we were let in everywhere. The nightclubs, the very posh night. It was full of millionaires.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the extras, if you look at the extras, they're all wearing their own mink clothes.
Yes.
They're all wearing. He said, I was speaking to the costume designer, he said, you know, I had this lorry full of clothes and all these extras came up. And I looked at what they were wearing. I said to my assistant, close the door. Close the door, because what they're wearing is far better than what I've got for them here.
See you next.
Absolutely. I mean, whatever. But I mean, you know, it's full of millionaires. It's full of people, all the big industrialists from Rome and Torino, Milano, and their families came up for that period of time to be there with them. So it was extraordinary. Oh, so there we are. Yeah. So, I mean, the premiere was sometime after. I think I went up to Pinewood for the rap, a rap party. And then I think Lynn Holly, she came to stay with me in my house, her and her sister, during that time. It wasn't the premiere. It must have been when she was actually doing some short, maybe, tie-ups in interiors at Pinewood. So we became very good friends. Charles Dance, John Wyman, I think I've told you that.
Yeah, no, you can tell us again.
We were inseparable. Inseparable, the four of us. It was wonderful. I mean, it was, and then, I mean, you know, I got back to London and the next day I signed on at the Labour Exchange in Brixton. So it was the actor's life from being up there down to there. And then and the premiere was, I didn't know what to expect. I went up to Edinburgh to do a play. Then I came down, I don't think I did Only Fools and Horses. I think it was after the premiere. And of course, I rang up someone. I said, do you have to wear any particular kind of clothes? And said, you're going to have to be a tuxedo or something like that, John. So I hired a tuxedo. My wife, well, she was my girlfriend, bought an elegant, I suppose, gown. And there we were. We parked in Covent Garden. We walked and there was the red carpet and all these fans.
Yes.
I couldn't believe it.
It was and royalty as well.
I never met them, but I think they were there. Maybe Charles was there, or somebody, or Diana.
Charles Diana, I think, yeah.
Yeah, they might have been there, but it was an extraordinary. And then we all went off to this party, this very posh party somewhere in Knightsbridge.
Oh, wow.
It was extraordinary time.
I'm presuming the future James Bond, Pierce Brosnan, was there as well, wasn't he? Because of his, with Cassandra Harris.
He didn't come to Cortina.
No, right.
No,
okay.
Those were in the more hot scenes, weren't they?
Yeah. But would he have been at the premiere, though, with her, possibly?
I didn't see him.
Right, okay.
I didn't see him. I mean, tragically, I didn't see him. But, I mean, I learned later of that tragic event. But It's desperately sad. But that's where I got to. And in the last 40 years, I've met Lynn twice. One at the Pinewood Memorial Service for Roger, where I met her again, and we went to we had a couple of meals. We're just up the road here and somewhere else in Sloane Square. But when she was here doing the interiors at Pinewood, I did take her to a play at the Royal Court, her and her sister. And it was, in those days, it was a kitchen sink drama.
Oh,
I mean,
right,
very real and very gritty.
It's an American watching that, yeah.
And there was one scene. It was very. Took place in Nottingham. The scene, and it was a, you know, and the man, the breadwinner of the house came back from work, opened the door, and said, "All right, love." And she said, "Your bath's ready," you know. So, and he had a bath and took all his clothes off. And his wife, who was about 56, the actress, she took all her clothes off and had a bath.
What?
And Lynn Holly and her sister shrunk down, trying to hide away.
Oh,
from
wow.
What was happening on the
Did
stage.
You not know that was going to happen?
No, they were so embarrassed.
Yeah.
Oh.
Innocent Americans.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Oh,
wow. Like BB, very innocent.
Yeah, absolutely. Not at all. No, I mean, she couldn't be, oh my God, my God. Oh, she was lovely. And she hasn't changed. I mean, I met her for the second time at Roger Moore's Memorial, and she was exactly the same. She looked the same. She was enthusiastic and witty and charming and full of beans and energy. And now she is here.
Yeah. Wow. You'll be meeting her.
I'll be meeting her on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Yeah, yes.
Are you going to take her to another dirty play then?
I was going to take her to a play with Mark Rylance called Jerusalem, which is
wonderful. Oh, yeah, fabulous, yeah.
But they're going to two musicals, so I'm not sure if they've got time.
Okay.
Oh. They're going to Les Mis and...
Well, when you're in London, I suppose. It's the done thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Mary Poppins, I think, is the next one.
I love it.
I mean, you probably can't get a ticket to Jerusalem with Mark Ryan. I've seen it already. It's a wonderful play.
Action. This is John Glenn. You're listening to Really 007 Podcast.
I'd love to ask about the character of Luigi himself.
Well, I did a lot of research.
Did you? Yes, yeah. Oh, no, I didn't.
What can you do with a character? I mean, I worked it out that this man was worked for the Secret Service, but it basically was a pen pusher. He wasn't a man in the field. He wasn't a James Bond. He wasn't one carrying guns and things like that. You know, he didn't have all these. He was a pen pusher. He was a bureaucrat. You know, he probably would have worked on a computer if it had been today.
Yeah,
you know, all he would have done would have done all that. You know, what you two are good at, but you know, going on, finding out all the secrets of the opposition and all that's what it would have been. So I thought, I'm going to play him as that, pretending to be a secret agent in the field, dressing as he was, totally incognito, when he looked like a sore thumb, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
I mean, that's the reason why they dressed him like that, because everyone they knew would be in après-ski, and he walks around as if he's walking around the streets of Roma.
Yeah, well, is that where you think his background would be? He wouldn't be from Cortina, would he?
No. He came up from Rome into Cortina. I assume that. And that's my motivation for the clothes that he put me in. Mm. But I'd already worked out that he couldn't have been a man in the field, that he was not a Roger Moore. He wasn't a 007, not at all.
Yeah.
But he was an information man. And that's what they wanted. They wanted him to get background on the two villains and things like that, which he knew about.
Because he did know Christatos, didn't he? And obviously,
absolutely.
He linked to Bond.
Yeah, and he refused to shake my hand.
Yeah,
we were going to ask about that.
In the rehearsal, he shook my hand, but on the take, he didn't.
Is that true?
Yeah.
So it was in character?
Oh, absolutely in character.
Oh,
and I think it was brilliant.
Brilliant.
It was
brilliant.
Superb, that.
Yeah, yeah. Moment.
Signor Christatos.
Ah. Christatos. Aris Christatos.
Bond. James Bond.
Would you care to join me in some blue wine?
That's a very good idea. Thank you.
Well, gentlemen, how can I help you?
We'd like some information.
Now, how can I help?
You know this man?
Yes. Locke, Colombo's right hand.
Milos Colombo. His name came up in connection with a smuggling operation last year.
That's the least of his offenses. Drugs, white slavery, contract murder. In the Greek underworld, he is known as the Dove. A very sick joke.
Where is this Dove?
Somewhere in Greece, I would guess. Once we were like brothers. Now he hates me. We fought together in the Greek resistance and against the communists. After that, he took a different path. Well,
thank you for your time, Mr. Christatos.
My pleasure. I leave for Corfu soon. If I get any more information, I will call Ferrara.
Because it's a bit of a whodunit for a Bond film. You don't know who to trust at that point.
No, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
It's pretty much the only one, actually, really, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Where
maybe Electric King, maybe.
Maybe Electric King, but the idea that Bond has dinner with the villain without realising that he is the villain.
We have more than dinner. We had the dinner he has.
Yeah.
But we also had a scene which was cut where we go to his villa.
Oh,
and we have
my word.
The big scene in the villa where we have this, you know, slap-up dinner and Luigi is enjoying his pasta, as you can imagine. And making remarks. We have this talk, so yes.
Oh, wow.
And then, of course, in the original script, at one point, I think I collect him from the ski jump. And then, you know, when he's escaping the bad man.
Oh,
you
know, Charles Dance.
Charles Dance. Yeah. And I meet him somewhere and I'm in the Lotus and he gets in and we drive away. And I'm driving the Lotus. And I'm playing around with the buttons. That's why in the scene when I die and he leaves me at the ice rink and he turns around and says, don't touch the buttons.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't make sense. But it did, of course. It would have got a good laugh had this seen scene where he's actually has pushed buttons.
Because you just see you in the background doing something like this.
Yeah, I'm just I'm driving and sort of... No! Yeah.
Won't take long, Luigi. Don't play with any of the switches, will you?
Right. So you drove a Bond car, and it's a beautiful car, isn't it? Oh.
Well, I never got to drive it, you see, because...
Because
John said, listen, we're running out of time. We've only got 3 weeks. We've got, and some of the special effects and the stunts, you know, they're so complicated. We haven't got time to shoot your dialogue scene.
Oh.
And the chippies and the sparks who had built that Cortina chateau dining room, they used to come up to me and say, we've done a great set for you, John.
Yeah.
You know, we just finished painting. It looks great.
Oh, wow.
And then John Glenn rang me up. I was in the hotel. He said, John, I've got some really bad news for you. We're going to have to cut 6 of your scenes. He said, it's a shame because if we'd have kept them, this might have done some great things for your career.
Oh, dear, John.
Well, I mean...
You did all right.
I did all right because I played Jesus Christ after all.
Yes,
I've actually played the devil as well. The two extremes.
Yeah. Which one did you prefer?
Well, Christ was... can we talk about
it? Yeah, of course you can. Absolutely,
Well, I went for the audition and I was given this very complicated 14th century text. 14th century. Very difficult stuff.
This was on the theatre, wasn't it?
No, this is for the BBC
Two. Oh, is it? BBC, BBC Two. Okay.
And I thought, this text, I said, Christ. He said, and more complicated than that, John, but we're actually going to do it in the accent of the period. In other words, 14th century accent, in which, in those days, the language was a mixture of French, or Norman French, and Saxon. And so when you came across a French Norman word like conversation, you would say conversation.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And when you came across an Anglo-Saxon word like knife or knight, you would say knicht.
Oh, yes. Yeah. It's like the Chaucer, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so he said, there we are. So there we are. He said, and I got the call a few weeks later and he said, you've got the part, John. And I said, oh, wonderful. He said, will you come up to the Alexandra Palace? We have to do a full cast of you. And so I had a whole day where they made a full cast of me. Front and back, the whole face, all the legs. They said, because at one point we are going to see the sword going into your body.
Oh, right. Yeah,
the sword,
yes.
The spear.
The spear,
so we can't have you do that because, you know, so it'll be a facsimile, you know.
Yeah, a long shot.
It was never used.
Oh.
No, they cut the scene. I don't know why. Maybe it was too gory. I don't know why. But anyway, we came to the scene where I was just before the nailing of the cross and I was on the floor being nailed by the Roman soldiers and I said... before we did this, and we never mentioned it before in rehearsal, but I called to the director, I said, when the first nail goes in, what do I express? Do I express pain?
Yeah.
No pain or violent?
Mm.
And he said, just a minute, John. He said, we're going to come down. And the director, the producer, and several theologians came down. I was on the cross and they were having this theological conversation above me.
Yeah.
And they're saying, we can't make up our mind. What do you feel? Is he a man? Is he not a man?
Yeah.
And so he said, we're going to shoot three versions. One of you not reacting hardly at all. One where you're reacting a little bit. And one you actually are in serious pain and you're trying to stop the soldiers from banging in the nail further. So, okay, I've never seen it, so I don't know which version they used.
Oh, right.
So,
but try and track it down for you, Joe.
Well, I might be able to. But, I mean, it was in those days, the crosses were pre-drilled.
Yeah.
So they put one nail in, and so you were attached that way. And if you're short or long, they attach ropes to your wrist, and they would heave your arm along till it got to the hole. Then you could bang it in. So quite often they would dislocate in the pulling, the three Romans or four Romans pulling you. And they did the same with the legs. They would attach a rope to your waist and pull you down to your wrist, and then they would nail you. Anyway, when we got to the cross, they hoisted me up there. They said, we're going to put you in a parachute harness. So you were in a parachute harness, and they attached the harness through the cross, and you were attached there. So you're hanging, merely hanging. And the nail heads were glued to your palms. So doing the rest, you could just simply put your arms through the ropes, and then you would be hanging on in the parachute harness. And this had taken a long time, nearly all morning. So by 10 to 1, they said, before we shot the film, they said, John, we've got a slight problem. It's lunchtime, and it's going to take, to get the cross down and get you out of the harness, it's going to take 20 minutes. And then we're going to have to put you back on the cross and put you back in the harness and hang you up. It's going to take another 20 minutes. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave you on the cross. So I was left on the cross for the entire hour of lunchtime in an empty studio while they all went off and I had lunch.
Oh, my word. So you were reliving it quite.
I was reliving
it. So you were, yeah. That's
incredible. Yeah, I was. I couldn't eat or drink anything because they couldn't get me off the cross and do any of those things. So I was really abandoned, really.
Oh, wow.
And it was quite good in a way because the feeling of being abandoned was quite good, because the next speech is when I talked to my father and saying, please forgive them, you know, I've been abandoned, that feeling of abandoned. Mind you, none of us could understand what we were saying because the accent was so, you know, we knew what the text was, but when we spoke it, neither of us could understand what we were saying because it was so extreme, the pronunciation, that period pronunciation. But so, yes, though there we are.
That's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, so they left me. But it worked quite well, because when I did that speech to my father, I did actually felt abandoned, because they had abandoned me. And no one came to see me. No. Are you all right, John? We'll only be with another half an hour. You're all right. Only one, the makeup lady came in and said, John, are you all right? Can I get you anything? Because I'd taken my hands out and I was just kind of leaning like this. And then,
oh, my word.
Extraordinary experience, yeah.
Wow. It's quite a responsibility playing Jesus, though, isn't it? I mean, in general.
I think so.
Yeah. And not many people get that part.
I know, there aren't many actors that play Jesus Christ, not many. No, I know the BBC came to interview me for about 30 years ago about, because I played Christ, they came to interview all the actors that had played Christ. And when they heard the story being left in the studio on the cross, they said, will you please come up to the studio and recount it to camera?
Yeah.
Come into the studio and say, this is where it happened, and tell us what happened.
Wow.
I don't think it was ever transmitted, but it was certainly filmed for the BBC to be put out on Christmas, on Easter. Yeah, it's Easter Sunday. No, it wasn't. It was Good Friday.
Good Easter Friday, Sunday. Yeah.
The resurrection and all that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice. It's
powerful, isn't it? Yeah.
Mm. It is quite powerful. Wow. Yeah.
Well, amazing. I mean, other things you've done, obviously, you only live twice.
Yeah.
Only Fools and Horses.
Another
big part for
you. I left For Your Eyes Only. I went up to Edinburgh to do a play, and I came down, and my agent rang me up and said, can you go and see a chap in the BBC to do a thing called Only Fools and Horses? It hadn't been transmitted yet, so I didn't know what it was.
Didn't know,
It was the very, very first series.
Yeah.
And I went to see the director, and he said to me, where do you live, John? I said, in Dulwich. He said, oh, that's next to Peckham, isn't it? I said, yes. He said, well, you can do the South East London accent, can't you? I said, yeah, I can. Great. Didn't hear anything for about a month. Then all of a sudden the phone rang and said, John, you got the part. And so there we are. So I did Only Fools and Horses, and it was an extraordinary experience because I had a maverick guitarist who was playing the tune, and I said to the director, I said, I'm tone deaf and I have no voice, So I'll need help from the guitarist to play the melody, otherwise I won't remember Old Shep at all. Well, it was fine during the rehearsal, except he started doing all the, you know, the flamenco stuff, and I said to the director, he's doing it again. You know, and he said, he could hardly speak English, and I could hardly speak Spanish in those days, because before I did my fight directing courses in Spain. Another one. But on the bloody tape with the audience, 400 audience present, he started doing improvisation. No. I thought, I don't know how I got through it. I have no idea how I got through it. I can't remember what I did. It was a blind thing, panic. You get through it, don't you, somehow?
You just have to, don't you?
So there we are. And
you've not seen it since?
I haven't seen it ever.
No, never seen it then?
I've never seen it, because I was doing a play somewhere. I can't remember where. No, I was in New York with Ian 10 years earlier. No, it wasn't. I don't know where I was, but I didn't see it, and there was no way of recording it, so I have never seen it. So I really have some of the Bond, Only Fools and Horses fans said, you can download it, you know.
Yeah.
You can. Tom, you're going to show me how to download this episode, because I can't do another one. Because they kept saying, can you sing Old Shep for us? I said, what? The fans, you know. I said, can you do some karaoke this evening? Because there's a big karaoke session, you know, afterwards for all the fans. Right, and yeah. I said, I can't sing. Well, I can't sing. And I can't remember the tune of that anyway. Do you know what it goes like, Old Shep? The Elvis Presley song? I didn't even know it was an Elvis Presley song.
I didn't even do it.
You've probably never seen that episode,
well,
either.
I've seen clips, but with you.
Oh, really?
But, I mean, they are available on YouTube and things like that.
I must get it.
But, that's incredible, isn't
it? I know. And when I was at the Mermaid Theatre, I worked with a fight director, very famous, who'd done lots of films with Errol Flynn, and he did all the fights. And he said, John, I'd learned a little bit in drama school. He said, you're quite good. Well, I could, because I could juggle, and my father was very dexterous, so I was hand-to-eye coordination was really good, and I could remember steps, because my father put me in ballet school when I was 8.
Right.
I was in a mining village in Skegby in the Midlands, and my dad wanted us to learn the piano, to sing, to do ballet, to do tap dancing. So we went to the local dance school in Mansfield, and I learnt all that. And it was so embarrassing. The local press did end of term dancing thing, and the photograph of me in second position in the local press. I went to school and they were saying, hey, great big dancy boy. You know, I didn't know what to say. No, but in those days, a bloke in a tutu and not but leggings and tights and doing one of those. Oh, it was so embarrassing. But anyway.
You mentioned the fight things, though.
Oh, yeah.
The fight coordinator.
And a fight arranger. No, Craig said, listen, can you be my deputy when I'm, you can take them through the routine that I've set and do all that. And I did. So the next year he was not available. So the director said, John, can you do all the fights? And it was incredible, because not only is there a fight in the beginning between Black Dog and Black Dog and Bones, then in the middle there is a big stockade fight with 20 pirates and then the goodies. And in that period, Spike Milligan was playing Ben Gunn, Willie Rushton was playing Squire Trelawney, and Barry Humphreys was playing Long John Silver.
Brilliant.
And I did all the fights. And at one point, there was this 20 pirates invading the stockade where the good blokes were there hiding. And the pirates were after the chart where the gold was, where the treasure was. And I choreographed all this. And at one point, the Captain Smollett, I said, you don't take out a sword in this. I'm going to give you pistols and you're going to shoot the pirates, as they come over the stockade. And these were caps, so you have to shoot and shoot, then you have to give them, they have to be reloaded, and two other ones are given to you, loaded. And Jim Hawkins, who's the young hero of the place, he's loading up all the pistols and he hands them to Captain Smollett and he shoots the pirates. So during the 4 weeks of rehearsals, I said to the actor playing Captain Smollett, I said, just say bang. So rehearsal, so the actor knows that he's been shot and can fall on the floor dead. And so for 4 weeks, bang, 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 So come the first night, all of a sudden he got the real pistols with the real bullets, well, blanks. And blow me down if the actor didn't go bang, bang, rather than pulling the trigger.
Oh, really?
And the pirate who was supposed to got to fall over dead, he went... He didn't know what to do. And I came off stage and I went to Captain Barrett. I said, do you know what you've just done? He said, what? I said, you've said bang rather than pulling the trigger.
This is like extras, isn't it?
That is something out of a comedy sketch.
It is. I said, what? I said, you said bang. I said, you didn't pull the triggers.
Professional people.
It was wonderful. I mean, after 4 weeks of saying bang, 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 the first night, the nerves, bang, you know, you say bang, bang, you've got... Yeah, you just don't get, you know.
Do you, mate?
Imagine that happening on a James Bond film. Yeah. You know, you're just doing For Your Eyes Only and Roger Moore just goes, bang.
I know. But, you know, in the theatre, there's no going back. I mean, terrible things happen in the theatre. I remember when I was doing, I think, I was doing this big fight as a Brian, I think I was, in that production. I did in the next production play Ben Gunn, but in that production I was playing one of the pirates. And we had this huge big fight up the riggings with cutlasses and things like that. And my cutlass just snapped in half.
Oh, gosh.
Just snapped it, because they get metal fatigue, you know, and they're used a lot.
Yeah.
And the half that broke, not attached to the handle, flew into the audience and hit someone across the face, the forehead, slashed her forehead open.
Oh, my.
So, I mean, you've got to be careful when you hire weapons. You don't know how often they've been used to get metal fatigue and things like that. It's very dangerous business. So you try to make sure that you don't do a swipe towards the stage. Yeah. And if you're doing a swipe, you do it upstage and not, you know. And I always, from that moment on, I always had a spare sword hidden in the set somewhere. Because it happened to me. I was doing the Scottish play in Denmark. And my sword disintegrated. No, it wasn't my sword. Yes, it was my sword disintegrated in the fight between Macduff and himself. I won't say the name because it's unlucky to say the name. The big fight. His sword disintegrated. That's right. It just fell apart in his hands, and we have this big fight. And I was supposed to kill him. Luckily, there was an actor off stage, and I'd set all the spares there. And he came on as for no reason at all and gave himself the sword, so we kept carry on fighting, and I stab him to death. They're an incredible thing. When we were doing that, I joined a company. We went touring Shakespeare in all of Africa, and then the next year, all the Far East.
Brilliant.
India, 10 weeks in India, Korea, Singapore, and 10 weeks in Japan. First night in Japan, theatre, 2,000-seater, did the play, took our bows. The actors went up to their dressing rooms. And the dressing rooms are to behold in Japan. The tables are not this height with the mirrors here where the actor can put on their makeup. No, the tables were down there and you had to sit on the floor to do the makeup. You know, anyway,
amazing.
We did the play, took our bow, went upstairs, changed them out of our costumes, and the PA system came alive and it was the floor manager saying, can John and Richard come down on stage immediately with your swords? And so we were in our T-shirts and jeans and we went down with our swords, which were rapiers, and I said, what's happening? He said, look, normally after the show the curtain comes down or it closes and I give them 5-10 minutes and I open the curtains and I see if they've all gone so we can take the curtain out and a working light appears on over the stage. He said, I paged the curtains and looked out and they were all there. Nobody had moved. And so I went out and I said to the audience, I said, the play's over, ladies and gentlemen, you can go home now if you wish. They said, no, we want to see the fight again.
Oh.
So the curtains open and playing Tybalt, I played Friar Lawrence and Tybalt, we did the fight again.
Brilliant.
Yeah, and it happened in Kyoto. It happened lots and lots of times.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
They wouldn't. A lot of them wouldn't have seen anything like that before, would they? So
No, they had never seen a Western sword fight for real. But in Kabuki and all those, they don't actually make contact.
Yeah.
And it's very balletic. It's almost like a ballet, you know.
Yeah.
But no, two blokes going at each other, trying to kill each other, you know. I mean, they were shocked because when Tybalt actually killed Mercutio under his arm, when, you know, he's being held back by the two other actors saying, no, stop, stop, stop.
Yeah.
And he's being held back and his sword's here. And Tybalt sees the opportunity, comes out and he just stabs him. And the Japanese were horrified. They thought it was such a cowardly thing to do.
Yeah.
He couldn't defend himself. He saw it coming. He couldn't defend himself. And they were almost hissed and booed.
Yeah, in that culture, yeah.
Yes. That's so dishonourable to actually stab a victim that couldn't actually defend himself, you know. But it happened so often in Japan. They just wanted to see the fights again. They loved the fights.
Yeah, they didn't.
And we did. I went to the University of Tokyo to do some demonstrations on sword fighting, you know, how to punch someone, how to slap someone, how to kick them in the private parts and not hurt them.
Yeah.
When I was teaching in the drama schools in, I choreographed fights in Madrid, Austria, and in Japan. But I was teaching in Seville, in Spain, a stage fighting in the drama school. And I was teaching how to kick someone in the private parts without hurting them. And making full contact. Making action contact. Yeah, full contact.
Oh, wow.
And I told them what to do and what the recipient should do and how and the position of the kick, how it should be, then knees must be straight. So I said, well, do it to me first. I told the actors, the boys, and the boys were really, really, really reluctant to do the kick.
They were.
Yeah.
But then I said, okay, with all that, now you, the actresses, all these beautiful Spanish actresses, students, came up and they really whacked me. They didn't hesitate.
Oh, no.
And I thought, isn't it extraordinary? I said, you girls really do want to kick someone, but the boys are reluctant to do it.
Absolutely.
I think because the boys know what it feels like.
Yeah. Gosh, it's awful, isn't it?
Speaking of you saying cowardice of somebody taking someone when they're unarmed, going back to the part of Luigi, and obviously Locke, we presume it's Locke who kills you in the car.
I don't know.
Because
it's not stated, is it?
It's not stated, and we weren't sure, because we thought initially it was the character Klaus played by Charles Dance, but then there's an extra scene that's deleted scene that he is one of the characters who gets beaten by Bond in the ice hockey scene. But obviously, we were talking about the death of Luigi as well. And it's quite brutal, especially on like Blu-ray now. Yeah, you can see the blood flowing from the neck and all this. And because you've said he's a bureaucrat and stuff, I suppose you've answered the question saying you're not sure, but would you imagine that it would have been Locke who did it?
No. I would imagine it was an assassin hired by Locke.
Yes, okay.
All right, okay.
That's how I imagine. I think Locke is the kind of character that probably wouldn't dirty his hands, I would think. But why they picked on Luigi, I've no idea. I mean, it was a big mistake because it brought the ire out of Roger.
Famous scene, yeah. I mean, it's probably one of the most remembered dramatic scenes, isn't it, in his whole seven films.
Oh, you mean the kicking the car over the edge?
And I know he wasn't keen on doing
it. So I've been told.
Yeah, but it's so effective, isn't it?
It is. It is. It is effective.
Left this with Ferrara, I believe. Had no head for heights.
Yeah, and Michael, the actor who plays Locke.
Yeah, Michael Gothard,
He died quite early, didn't he? I went and had I was invited to have a meal in his house and his lovely wife, and it's shocking when some of your friends go. I'm a member of Equity and I'm on the Equity Fight Register as well, but you get these annual obituary reports on people who are no longer with us, and it's deeply sad.
Really, it is, isn't it?
That we're all mortal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm getting nearer to it all the time. You've got you're at the beginning of the race. I'm on the last furlong.
We've got all these amazing stories.
Yeah, that's what I mean, John. What a life.
But that scene, like we keep saying that Roger was such a good actor as well as a comedian.
I think he was, you know, because people take the mickey out of the eyebrows and you can't do it. Listen, it's very difficult.
It is very difficult
to do that part, really is. Yeah. I mean, any kind of part that is not, there's no great depth written in the dialogue, you know, it's difficult to play.
Yeah.
To play ruthless and charm and gentlemanly all at the same time. Some of the actors can do the ruthlessness and the other people can do the charm.
Very true.
But to get all the three yeah. together, that he is a gentleman. It's funny. It's very strange about talking about Ian Fleming. I was in Ochfelden, where my mother comes from, just outside Strasbourg. And there was an exhibition and in the local synagogue, for some reason, a historical. And there were all exhibitions of all the memorabilia that had been brought over by secret British agents that had been parachuted into occupied France. And all the stuff that was captured by the Germans and put on exhibition. It was all there. And there were books written by Ian Fleming in that collection.
Wow.
There you go.
I said, I don't believe it. I went to the exhibition. I saw all the things and all the bits and pieces that Fleming had obviously written about. And there was a book on the process of how, you know, if you land and what you do with the dagger and how you approach and in the museum.
That's fascinating. Isn't it? Yeah.
Wow.
I think Few Eyes Only was, John Glenn wanted to get it back to the Fleming a bit, didn't he? It's a bit more ruthless, isn't it? And realistic. I suppose it was after Moonraker, of course.
Yes.
So,
well, you've spoken to John Glenn.
We have spoken to him, yeah.
He has views about, I suppose, about what it's like now and what it was like then. And the combination of that, because he obviously Ian Fleming was a gentleman.
Yeah.
And he just thought that's what he'd be. He'd be a gentleman with a wonderful English sense of humour.
He was what Ian Fleming wished he was, wasn't he, really?
Yeah, I think. And otherwise, it's Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
And I don't think it should be.
What's your opinion on the later stuff? Have you seen a few of the later
stuff? I have. I've seen all of them.
Yeah.
Because they come through BAFTA. And it's like, you know,
sure, yeah.
BAFTA, so, but, and they've taken a different path. I mean, it's not up to me to judge, but the actor themselves decided that he wanted to make the dark side more prominent and less humour. It's up to you. You're the fans. I mean, he's a wonderful actor.
Yeah.
He's a wonderful actor. I've seen him do lots of other parts long before he became a
007. Yeah, yeah.
Daniel is a wonderful actor. I mean, he's a really serious actor and a humour. He can do all of it. So his view of, with Barbara and the directors, they took a line on what they wanted Roger to be. I mean, 007 to be. I hope you cut that one.
No.
I mean, you know.
They're quite different bonds, though, aren't they?
But then,
as I say, Roger can... Well, Daniel can do the humour and Roger can do the hard side work, but it's just not as prevalent, I suppose.
Yes, I mean, whether in retrospect Daniel thinks that maybe the humour should be more prominent, but maybe, I don't know, because there's so many films now. I've got all those stunts, so you've got to bring something else. You can't just have fun with something. You've got to have scenes and humour and that charm.
Yes, charm, you
know, what Daniel brings to it, it brings a great humanity to the part as well.
Yes.
You know, whether you think there should be a huge backstory to the character of 007 or not is debatable. I don't know.
Well, they've done it, haven't they? And
it's
a different way of doing it, and there'll be a different way of doing it next, which will be interesting. And it might be more like Roger did it.
But it's interesting because For Your Eyes Only is probably the biggest character study that Roger did, because it starts with the first scene is him attending his wife's grave, and then there's this whole thing about revenge all the way through, because obviously the revenge for the death of yourself, of Luigi, and then he's teaching Melina all the way through to not avenge her parents by killing Christatos and stuff. So there is this character study that Roger goes through in that, but it's never at the expense of the story. There's always a...
Yeah, central thread, isn't
it? It's a central thread throughout it. And my observation with the later ones is that there is a real focus on the character of Bond, but not necessarily a focus on the story. So I couldn't tell you what the villain's motivation was in the previous film.
Do you know, it's very strange about that, how important a villain is to a Bond. The great Bond films had good villains as well, didn't they?
Yeah, they did, yeah.
Very important. You get a good villain and it helps. It helps the central character. You get a weak villain and he's got nothing to play against. You know,
Blofeld and the new villain, Safin, didn't they?
I was, my own reservation about the latest one is that the villain is not, you see too much of him. I like the idea that you don't see him at all.
Yeah, like the original Blofeld.
Yeah, you just see his hands and maybe his voice and you don't see much, the back of his
Dr.
head.
Dr. No as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting about not seeing what, if you let the audience imagine what he's capable of.
Absolutely.
I remember in as a as a very young actor in my very first rep job, I was doing a character who was working class window cleaner and he was being interviewed. I've got a cap on, a bit like the one I've got down there, wherever it is, over there.
Get your props.
I've got the cap on. You get me props. There I got go. The cap on, and it was a mock television studio, and I was being interviewed, and the interviewer had his back to the audience, and he's got his mic, and I was facing the audience, and I got my cap on like that. And I answered all the questions like that. You know, never took my cap off. And the director says, John, we can't see your face. I said, I know. I said, this will work with the dialogue. If you see my face, it won't work. Because all of a sudden, they can imagine what I look like. You do that, and all of a sudden, it's a different character. And it's so important. You get that. Let them work a bit. Let the audience work a bit, because they're good at it.
Trust the audience. This is
really good, the imagination.
Yeah, I love that.
It's so important. And yet, you know, people, the trouble is, you know, like, for example, do you need to see a car accident with people flying through the air and all the blood everywhere? Or do you let the audience visualize what happened?
That's why it's more effective with your death.
Yeah, absolutely.
He comes back and the music, there's just a little musical cue and it's like the look on his face.
Yeah.
And then just to see you like pour out of the car.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, good grief. Little Luigi, poor Luigi.
I know. In that scene there, it was about minus 30. We were so cold.
I
had 5 pairs of gloves on. When they took just to put the thing in my hand. After the cut, put the gloves on straight away. It was so cold. And of course, in the Lotus, it's so low.
Yeah.
When you open the door, if I'd have fallen out, I wouldn't have been able to fall out.
Yeah, because you're right there. Yeah.
I wouldn't. I had to catapult myself out into that position. Just toppling out like that, because there were, you know...
You really work
hard to get out that and fall out of that car. Really work hard. Oh, it was.
You didn't film the death, did you?
The killing?
Yeah, it wasn't filmed, no.
No, that was never in...
With Thomas Wheatley, they filmed that, didn't they? With Saunders' death.
Oh, right, yeah.
But I think they had his body dismembered, but they thought, no. I think John Glenn thought, no, we don't need to see that.
You don't need to see
the audience, the horrific bit is knowing he's dead.
You don't need to see
it.
And it's like the VJ one in Octopussy where
they say...
You know, they said he was alive when we found him, and it brings an image. You know, you don't see that, but it brings an image in the audience's head about what this could happen.
Yes, the trouble with modern directors, they dot the I's.
Yes.
They leave nothing to the audience to do.
Mm.
That's why quite often they don't get involved, because everything is there for them.
Yeah.
I remember a director said to me once when I was in a play at the Mermaid called Galileo Galilei about the great astronomer.
Yeah.
You know, I was playing the little monk, and he has a traumatic experience with. In the dialogue, he actually breaks down, and the director said, "Don't get emotional, John. Don't get emotional, because if you cry, the audience won't cry. Just tell them the facts. Let them do the work. They will do it for you."
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah. Don't do it for them. Let them do it.
It is that show don't tell, as we keep saying, and oh, gosh.
It's these little nuggets of information.
Even like Roger's face when he's got Locke on the edge of the cliff, it's not a lot of, he's like, oh, you just kill my friend. If he'd done that, it wouldn't have worked, would it?
No.
It's just that cut, you can tell he looks so angry. And I think he did feel sorry for you that you were caught up amongst all this.
Yeah, this is unfortunately because the 6 scenes have been cut.
Yeah.
You didn't see that build up of the relationship.
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden, there was a meeting at the top. We had the little blue vine by the ice ring, and then I was dead. So that we'd had 6 scenes to get a real good relationship. Then it would have made sense for him to be so angry and vengeful.
Because John Glenn, he liked the sacrificial lamb character. In all these films, there's this poor ally who is here to help Bond, and he ends up dead.
Yeah. It's always very good, that.
Yeah, well, it works.
It's a good idea. It's not a bad idea to use that mechanism.
I've got to be honest, but he told us about the sacrificial lamb. He said it was such satisfaction. Make likable characters just to kill them off.
Just to kill them, yeah.
I mean, it happens. I mean, Shakespeare was very good at that.
Yeah.
Some of the mate, like Tybalt, is a wonderful character.
Yeah.
Has them killed off almost immediately.
Oh, dear.
No, quite early. Because while I was playing Tybalt and Fry Lawrence, you could do the two. You could play because one is dead before the first appearance. When we were in Africa, and Tybalt, get killed, lying on the floor, middle of the jungle, middle of nowhere, lying on the floor dead. And I was got my eyes, I was my back to the audience, lying down with my front backstage, and the actors, two actors talking, finishing the scene. And I looked across on the floor, and there was this ginormous spider walking towards me across the floor. And I was lying down dead, and it was getting close.
Oh, my word.
Close. I thought, what am I going to do? I'm not going to let that thing come and walk all over me. I thought, I'm going to play Lazarus and just get up and walk up there. Lucky the actors who were acting, they saw it and they just stopped.
Oh, really? Yeah.
They stomped on it.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
There's some...
Rap theatre.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you come across wonderful moments like that.
And,
yeah.
One thing I wanted to ask you is the accent you adopted... You were saying you were told maybe it was a bit too much to start.
Yeah, the original soundtrack was just as a guy track, really. And then you go post-sync months later.
Is that a Pinewood then?
Yes, it was a Pinewood in the sound studio. And they said, we've got some, I don't know, it was John or maybe it was Cubby. It said, can you just lighten the actress a bit more? It was just too heavy. And so I just had to do what the accent do you now see and hear is a slightly...
So what, can you just give us a bit of a rendition of what it used to be like?
Oh, I can't. I mean, the snow is... the snow in... It's better at Innsbruck.
It wasn't as bad as that. But
yeah, I mean, something like that. Yeah. You know. At Innsbruck, as you would say, they put an extra syllable on the end of the word, don't they?
It maybe makes them a bit too jovial, doesn't it, then?
I think they were worried about people not understanding.
Oh, right, wow. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, that was the main concern. We've got to understand you. Got to understand you. Of course, they always speak quite good English, don't they?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it's got to be quite light.
What do you think, Luigi? Does this Dove, Colombo, have the resources to mount a salvage operation?
Oh, definitely. He runs a fleet of intercoastal freighters in the Aegean. I ring my office in Milan. They may have more on him.
I mean, it's so good what you did because it's left such a legacy.
Yeah,
I'm really humble when you say things like that.
No, it's true though.
It is. It is.
You know, these are films that we have grown up with, and they're our go-to films. They're our comfort blankets.
Yeah,
these are like our favourite films ever. And we're going to, you know, we're going to be going to the Prince Charles in a bit.
I know.
And you're going to have hundreds of fans in exactly the same boat who micro characters of films they're obsessed with. And, and they'll be hearing these stories about yourself and just thinking, what an amazing franchise. But how amazing it is that so many people involved in this series, was it 40 plus years on, have got so many fond memories that there's a family still there that, you know, you've got friends from that set. And just thank you so much for your time to share this because it's just so heartwarming for us to hear.
Oh, well, I mean, thank you for... I've never done this before, so it's extraordinary experience. And you've all been... No, I'll tell you one story, which is an interesting thing. When I was in the army and I went to do my basic training, there was an Alsatian of people from Strasbourg.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Not the dogs. The captain of the training camp, he was an Alsatian. He's called Captain Schmidt. Mm. It's a typical Alsatian, a Strasbourgian name. And he called me in and he said, English... I am not going to give you a rifle to fire during your training. No weapons at all. I'll never forgive you for Joan of Arc. Joan of Arc.
We're going back a bit, aren't we?
I said, what? Joan d'Arc, he said.
Yeah.
Oubliez pas Joan d'Arc.
Wow.
It's a wonderful story, isn't it? So I never got any basic training.
So
when I went back to the captain, and I said, they wouldn't let me use a rifle. He said, don't worry. We go on training all the time. We'll go on a rifle range. We'll teach you how to do it. Joan of Arc. God, people hang on to things, don't they?
Quite a bit of that, isn't it?
It is. Oh, yeah. I mean, little things like that, you just don't forget, do you?
No, not at all.
What a life, John.
What a life.
An amazing set of stories. Thank you very much, John, for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. My pleasure. It's a great pleasure for me. I've never done it before, and I hope we can do it again. I hope I'll be able to come and see you in Manchester one day.
Oh, yeah,
please,
definitely.
Please
come
down. Yeah.
Oh, that'd be lovely. We'd love to meet some of your friends and have a chat.
Yeah.
Because I haven't been there since I worked with Ian McKellen in the Actors Company.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much, John. John, very much. And the cameraman, thank you very much. I'm sure that's going to be cut.
Really,
Douglas.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.